Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
The kids on Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
Halloweenies, a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
From the Consequence Podcast Network, the minds behind The Losers Club, comes a new podcast in fantasy terror.
Nancy, there's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Halloweenies, a Freddy Krueger podcast.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey to all you pod people out there, I'm your engineer, Adam Kivel, and this is This Must Be the Gig, your backstage pass to the world of live music. Every week we bring you a fascinating conversation from the heart of the performance scene, and that could mean a musician, a festival founder, a choreographer, a comedian, an actor, really anyone obsessed with music and performance the way we are. Your host, Lior Phillips, is on the road this week, so I'm going to be giving you the intro this week just by myself. Before we get to our conversation for this episode, we've got everyone's favorite new feature here at TMBTG Studios. It's the live show of the week, where we highlight one of the most heart-thumping events out there and share it with all of you. Hopefully you can get out there and get to this gig. For this week's live show of the week, we're looking at Hart and Joan Jett teaming up at the legendary Hollywood Bowl on Monday, September 9th. That is a jam-packed night if I've ever heard one. I love both of those acts. I've been a big Hart fan ever since I first got my mom's records when I was a teenager. So I'm very jealous of this one. Hollywood Bowl is one of those world famous venues that I have yet to attend, but would really love to in the future. Hint, hint, if anyone at Hollywood Bowl is hearing this, the best place to get in on the excitement of that show or any other is to head over to StubHub via cos.lv/StubHub. To find the best selection of tickets to the hottest shows, including Hart and Joan Jett at Hollywood Bowl. That's cos.lv/StubHub. One more little bit of business before we move on to this week's interview. I want to urge you to head over to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to podcasts like this one, and leave us a 5-star review. Subscribe, rate, review. It's all so important. It's essential for us to keep bringing you exciting new episodes like this one, so thanks for everyone that's done it, but really, you absolutely have to do it. It's a law. I didn't make the rules. That's just the way it is. You have to go do it. 5 stars, please. Thank you. Let's return the attention to this week's incredible chat. After playing in a variety of bands as a teenager in London, Alexis Taylor met Joe Goddard at Elliott School in Putney. The two shared an interest in fusing electronic rhythms, synths, and punk energy with a quirky sense of humor, eventually resulting in the formation of the now-beloved group Hot Chip in the year 2000. The title of their debut album, Coming On Strong, set a clear forecast for the band. The group quickly earned rave reviews for their off-kilter yet imminently groovable records and passionate live performances, leading to highlights including a 2009 Grammy nomination for the unstoppable Ready for the Floor. Most recently, the now nearly 20-year-old act released A Bathful of Ecstasy this June via legendary indie label Domino, and we've got a quick taste of that before we get to our interview, so stick through that. But in this chat, you'll hear Lior and Alexis discuss the origins of Hot Chip, their shared love of Devo, the tragic loss of producer Philippe Zadar, working with Katy Perry, and the appeal of Kanye West's Bound 2. That's quite the range of topics, so let us not be delayed. This is Lior and Alexis. Enjoy!
Have you left space for me in this life? Cause there are voids into which we cannot dream in this life.
It's very crazy. Well, it's not really crazy. It's quite predictable. Lots of shows in a row.
Mm.
It's not surprising. It's not crazy, but it's busy. Yeah, it's very busy. Today, I'm not on tour, but tomorrow, I'm in the Netherlands. And then Saturday, I'm in Belgium. Sunday, I come home. And then Monday, I go to America for a month.
Oh,
and then after that, it carries on. Lots of touring.
Yeah.
Japan, UK tour, European tour, South American tour, yeah, so there's a lot.
How much of that are you able to monitor? Like, how much of the planning and things like that to make sure that you can get home and spend some time at home as well and not just be on the road for a long time? How much, you know, involvement do you have there?
We have a lot of involvement. I mean, we get asked whether we're happy to do the touring.
Yes.
It's all proposed to us. It's not just a kind of
gotta go out and tour again.
We're not kidnapped.
Yeah.
But at the same time, yeah, it's a bit difficult, but I'm trying to focus on the positive side of it, which is we get to tour and play these shows and travel, and you know, I will be missing my family. But when they can, they come out to join us. When we need, you know, but it's a bit tricky, like the American tour, that's not possible because of school. But you know, that's just something that we put the record out, and we want to play some shows. We want people to hear us playing it live. We want to, you know, kind of make the most of the fact that people seem to be interested in this record and what we're doing. On the whole, so it would be crazy to not tour. That's my honest answer. You know, I love touring, but I also love being with my family and being in London. Mm. So I just have to make it work, both those things.
Yeah, I think that there's always there's that duality, because obviously when you're in it, it's like that instant gratification of being so close and that visceral feeling of having your fans, you know, reacting to your music. But then I can imagine you get a similar satisfaction, or even better, when you're home and also able to write and able to do other things. So
yeah.
What is that one thing then that connects you to your creativity when you're at home? Because obviously it's kind of an easy portal to get to when you're on stage, because you can feel, you can hear, you can touch. Hopefully you can't, you know, taste much of it. Well, maybe from sweat, but you know what I mean? Like, how do you get that then when you're home?
Well, in some ways, it's easier to be more creative at home. You know, when you're on tour, you're not necessarily creating. You're performing. You're performing something that you've created already. Of course, you're creating some new experience, a new version of the songs you're playing every night. And I think that you are doing something really special by doing that, as long as you're all enjoying doing it and, you know, happy making music and feeling creative. But you can be just as creative at home, because you have time to think and feel things, and you may be inspired by being with loved ones, family, friends, other things going on in your life other than being, you know,
right,
in a bus or in a dressing room. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's quite a lot that's more inspiring and creative about being in other places as well. Or being on a break from touring can also be, you know, a place where you really get your head around what it is you're trying to do creatively.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I feel like I spoke to you a few years ago, many, many years ago, about one of your solo records. I don't know what year it was. Obviously, we touched on a lot of the album, but also just your finding that collaborative value with your band members, and knowing that even if you are touring and or writing your solo music, you still feel that creative pull from your band, which I think after so many years is something you can't really overlook anymore. You know, that is definitely a special connection that you've been able to forge. So how have you kept that fire?
Yes, I totally agree.
Yeah. How do you manage to keep it in such a way that it's constantly refreshing to you, as opposed to something that you're going to like this same slog, you know? How do you make sure that the band collaboration and that the music that you're making and that that whole experience is as positive as possible?
Okay, well, what I think is really important is everybody in the band has their own life experiences, obviously. And so each time you're working on something together, everybody is able to bring something new. I mean, I don't mean that every single day in the studio it's like always easy to make music. Sometimes maybe it's harder than other days, depending on people's creativity or mood or whatever. But on the whole, the fact that it's a group of people means everyone's experiencing something slightly different all the time, and then they bring those experiences and how they affect what they would like to do musically to the table. And also, they're not just blank canvases, each of us in the band. You know, they're really creative people, and there's a bond as friends between each of us too. And there's things that Joe will do, for example, musically, that I couldn't do, and things that I would do that he couldn't do, and that Owen would do that is different from how Al would do it, and what Felix can bring. You know, everyone is basically kind of aiming towards something that will work together, but offering their own input and creativity based on what they've experienced and how they're feeling and how we're all feeling. I think if you stop enjoying music and you're not inspired to make music and you're not inspired by other people's records or anything or art around you or what's happening in the world or things in your relationship, it may lead to it being a struggle. But I think that we're lucky that everyone wants to keep going and keep making records. But also we are genuinely exploring new things that interest each of us as individuals and that overlap with each other. So if one person, I don't know, is like really enjoying a particular type of music or sound or production or rhythm, that inspiration that they have, it's infectious, you know. You get excited to work with them on what they bring to the table. And I think if it's just one songwriter, one producer, and a series of session musicians, then maybe that dynamic is quite different. But with Hot Chip, it's two principal songwriters, me and Joe, and everybody else also making really big contributions to what we're doing, and just sort of feeling vaguely similar about what they want to do musically. I don't know if that's really an interesting answer, but that's the kind of reality of it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think the fact that we like each other is pretty important.
Yes,
you know, I think
exactly.
The fact that we respect each other and are kind of in awe to some extent of what each person is capable of doing creatively, that's pretty essential to the thing working. And I feel really lucky that when I met Joe, Owen, Al and Felix, each of them, like, it's just really, really good at what they're doing. And we don't spend all of our time just like in disagreements. We do have disagreements, but there's enough of a common ground and excitement about making records that it keeps going. And also this time around, we deliberately chose to put ourselves in a slightly new situation, work with two different producers on the album.
Right.
We'd never worked really with any producers before. Now we were working with two. They were both unfamiliar to us. Both of them brought very different things to the group. I think that injected some new life. But also we did loads of hard work before we even met those producers and basically made the foundations for all of the songs before we met them. So we didn't just rely on that. But that was a useful thing to do in terms of having the opinion and guidance of these two producers, Roddy and Philippe. And I think making music and being in the room with other human beings is, you know, it's an opportunity to to feel a connection with those people and to talk about music and to make music and to make decisions together. And it's, you know, that I've always found that quite exciting about collaborating in the past when I've worked with About Group, when we first all got together as a band, that was all about collaboration and working with producers like these two, Philippe Zadar and Roddy McDonald, you know, that involved letting those people in and allowing them to help guide what we do. And that's probably another important factor in helping the band make 7 albums rather than stopping after 4 or something.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking for something new. We're looking for a way to express something that is meaningful to us and meaningful to other people, but find a new way in which to say that. And I'm not saying that we're iconoclastic and breaking the mold every time we do anything, but
right.
we're trying to you know?
Absolutely. And you feel that progression, you know, that connection between, you know, Why Make Sense and this album. I feel like it's a natural progression, even though there's been years between them. And I must say, I'm so sorry to hear about Philippe and what happened. I can only imagine.
Yeah, it's awful. Yeah.
Just having to reflect on that months afterwards as well. Every time, I can imagine that's quite difficult. So I suppose, what is the one thing that really makes you smile when you think of working with him and the experience of having him work with you in the studio and on the album?
If it had to be just one thing, then it would be seeing him bouncing in the studio whilst we were like creating some of the music. So he would become very animated and kind of physically demonstrative about how much he was enjoying the music. And he would also be, you know, he'd come into the live room and sort of listen to what we were doing in that room, but be so excited by it that he's shouting to the other room, to the control room, to make sure that Antoine is pressing record and we're not missing anything. And, you know, and then he would be like, guiding each of us like by clapping and sort of supporting what we were doing, like the melodies we were playing and the way that 5 of us were playing things that were sort of locking in together. He would let you know if that was working, and he would never stop you in the middle of the flow if it wasn't working, but I think it was working most of the time. So yeah, it was his physical embodiment of pleasure and music and how it affected him. That's the kind of one thing that I would say.
That's wonderful.
But also he was also very good at just being on mixing the music, and when he would do the mixing, he would be dancing whilst mixing, you know. So he wasn't like a kind of quiet, subdued person who was lost in his thoughts. He was quite, you could read the fact that he was enjoying it.
Right.
And it reminded me of Lee Perry. Not that I've ever been in the room with Lee Perry, but it reminded me of like footage of Lee Perry mixing on a mixing desk whilst dancing and like feeling the vibe of the music. And that was really lovely to experience. I also enjoyed just talking to him about records and Prince records and all of his different funny experiences. He was very amusing, you know. He was quite a kind of jovial person. So there was lots of different stuff that we could all talk about and enjoy with him. It was obviously really, firstly, it was really shocking and strange to hear. He died, I think, the day that our album, maybe it was the day before our album came out, or maybe it was the day that it came out and the day that his own Cassius album came out. So I woke up in the morning, we were about to play the like London show that was the kind of record release party, and the first messages I got on my phone in the morning were about this awful accident and him having died. So it was very, very weird to be working with him so closely, and
absolutely.
I was texting him about a week before that. But not to focus on it too much, but you know, the very nicest thing is that at least the music contains some of his spirit.
Absolutely.
In all of the records that he's worked on. So, you know, you can hear them and be reminded of him and think of him and feel him.
Exactly.
In the mood of it and the memories of just being in the room making that music with him. So that's important.
Absolutely. And thank you for sharing, because I think that everybody was just as shocked, but I can't even imagine, because you were so close and the timing of it all. And, you know, there's just, it's so heavy. And I just think, I just think that remembering those little things are so wonderful. And you clearly enjoy having that close relationship with the people that you're working with. So when did you first realize that you were an artist? What was that moment, or first think of yourself in that way?
When I was at school, I was in a band. I think I kind of formed the band, but we didn't have any vocals, and we were just playing at lunchtime, practicing in the music room. And when I transitioned from just being a keyboard player in this band to writing the song, I think that was the beginning of feeling much more connected to something I knew I wanted to do but hadn't been able to do, which was to write and create music rather than just cover other people's music. So that was a kind of inkling of something. But then I remember there was one song I wrote, and I played it at the piano on my own, not with a band, at school. And it got a nice reaction from people, you know, friends of mine and family and, you know, parents and different people that were there. And it probably wasn't very good, but it was actually like a completely written song that I performed in front of people, and I didn't really feel nervous about doing it. I felt quite like this is how I feel, and it's coming out in music. And that was quite a nice moment of recognition that it just felt natural and felt good to be doing that, rather than, well, maybe I'm interested in music, but I'm more of a behind the scenes person or something.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like the act of getting up there on your own performing. And that has really stayed with me. So even though at the beginning of Hot Chip's career, there was quite a lot of focus on our sense of irony and our humor and poking fun at things and people not knowing whether to take it seriously and always talking about us as nerds and things.
Yes.
There was also a real emotional backbone to the music and the words. And there was this thing that I cared a lot about. Maybe I said it to you when we talked before, I don't know, but I really cared about the words being kind of direct and emotionally frank.
Absolutely.
And the people that I liked in music and in writing, like Raymond Carver or Bill Callahan, as he's now known, but Smog as he was then, and you know, they had that in their music or in their short stories, a kind of, or Willie Nelson's lyrics as well. Something where what I was striving for was a position you can put yourself in where you're kind of bearing all emotionally, and you don't do that to make people feel uncomfortable, and you don't feel uncomfortable about it yourself. It's kind of that's the mode that you want to work in. And that is something that obviously now that we've been doing it for a long time, people are a bit more familiar with the different things going on in Hot Chip, and they don't just say, oh, it's like, is it for real, or is it just ironic, or
yeah,
you know, they can kind of tell that with, I mean, obviously there's still humor sometimes, but do you know what I mean? The only reason I mention any of that is because I think that early performance, which may have been quite earnest, does kind of that thread runs through since then.
Yeah, I feel like that definitely comes across. I think especially just listening to your music before it being able to experience you live, which happened to me, I feel like there's you've written some of the most beautiful lyrics of the decade. Like, I feel like there's things in, you know, your first albums that you know, like take it in. There's such beautiful lyrics in that song. And even just, you know, I mentioned Why Make Sense earlier. That was kind of weirdly a heavier themed album than what people might have expected just listening to the melody. And going into now with A Bath Full of Ecstasy, there's a lot of themes and things that you tackle, as you said, in quite a frank way that allows for people to ask questions without feeling really heavy and bogged down by the intellect, you know? You can tap into it quite easily. Well, at least for me, it's so accessible that it's like a nice thought, as opposed to, oh, must I feel like this now? You know, there's no pressure. There's never been any pressure in your music, which is what I think your fans appreciate.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of that makes sense.
There's no pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that does. Yeah. I think that it's quite hard to explain exactly how and why you arrive at a particular way of expressing yourself. But when you were talking just then about the lyrics in Why Make Sense maybe touching on heavier themes and then it not feeling too kind of tricky to understand that or to get that from it, it just made me think of all kinds of music I like, but the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson came to mind first of all, that you know, people can find a way to say something in a song which is quite deep and affecting, but in a way that is really accessible and can draw the listener in. The listener might not even be paying attention to it the first time they hear it, but the melody in a Beach Boys song, like In Your Room or something like that by the Beach Boys, is, you know, it's an introspective song that is very kind of beautiful and powerful and speaks to lots of people but comes from one person's mind and is catchy, melodic, easy on the ear, whilst being sophisticated musically and harmonically and emotionally, but naive and sort of direct enough to capture what it is like for a teenager or a young person to be experiencing loneliness or, you know, solitude. And I think, you know, that if those things go in deep for you as a listener, then you're inspired by them and you kind of, you don't try and copy, but you maybe want to do something that makes you feel similar when you make your own music. And I suppose that is like one of the places Hot Chip is coming from, is from that kind of taking what you experience and feel deep inside and then like putting that across in music.
Looking at a calendar full of great events but struggling to find tickets? StubHub's got you.
Whatever your favorite band, team, or venue, StubHub is here to save the day with the best tickets for any budget. Whether you're looking for a seat at a Broadway show, tickets to the summer's big arena tour, or a night of cheering on your hometown team, StubHub has the seats you're looking for at the price you want to pay. Head to StubHub.com or their user-friendly app to find tickets that are 100% guaranteed by Fan Protect.
StubHub's never sold out with the most shows, the most tickets, and the most fans. That's StubHub.com or the StubHub app. The best tickets to the best experiences in music, sports, and theater.
Not worrying about how's this going to work or is it going to be too personal, or you're just sort of accepting that that's where you feel comfortable being. And of course it's not for everyone, and some people don't get anything out of it and some people get something different out of it, you know, but that's one of the things going on. I think that Joe, because Joe's not doing this interview and it's me, I can't speak for him, but he feels similarly to me. But I also think he sometimes wants to write words that touch on new ground for him, and maybe, you know, maybe they don't always need to be a kind of relationship or love song or emotionally heartfelt thing. They might, I think a lot of them are, but he might also like when he wrote the lyrics to I Feel Better, the verses of that, and I just wrote the choruses to that and he wrote the verses. Like, he was writing from a place of talking a bit more about humanity and destruction, violence that people have towards, as a race, we're a violent race, you know, he talks about that. And he, you know, he's not really just sticking with the subject matter that may have been there earlier on in the material. So I think there's, you know, different things occupy your mind and thoughts and kind of trouble you or interest you, and that's what comes out in the music, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like there's that moment when you play the Bruce Springsteen LCD Sound System cover is kind of, I think, one of the most heart-thumping moments I feel I've ever had at a concert. I saw you at Iceland Airwaves in 2015, I think it was, and you're playing that weird, I don't know if it was like an old hall or something. It was a strange venue.
Yeah.
Very far away from
the
center of Reykjavik. And I'd been photographing the show and stopped and actually hopped over the barricade to get to the front. So instead of like going waiting at the back, I was really rude and asked the fans if they could make some space, and they did, which was amazing. But I swear to God, that barricade, felt like it was gonna collapse because people were losing their... I definitely was lifted up off the ground. Like, everyone else's bodies were lifting me up during that performance.
Yeah.
I think it was just so moving and life-changing. And I feel like, as you mentioned, even doing a cover, you chose something that really was quite aspirational. And that I find a lot of your music, the questions that you ask in the lyrics, you and Joe... it feels kind of hopeful sometimes in a way. And then you have this crazy light show and all these costumes. And so do you still get, like, where did the inspiration come to have the performance be as important as what you were singing about, what you were writing about? How did you make sure that there was that equal, fair kind of marriage between the two?
I don't think that we... kind of plan that or consider it too much. We, you know, we started off playing live a long time ago, and we were really having to find our feet, as it were, you know, find a way to do it well live. And we weren't necessarily natural performers, front people, you know. We were quite unconventional in lots of ways in terms of how we looked on stage and things. But over the years, we've got better at it, but also we felt passionate about doing it and excited to be performing. And when it comes to the kind of staging of the shows and, well, I'm kind of jumping around a little bit. I feel very comfortable on stage now, and always, like I said when I was describing performing that song when I was at school at the age of 13 or whatever, 14 or something. You know, there's something about it that it's like, yes, this feels really good and where I'm meant to be. But then there's, you know, a few other things when we began doing Hot Chip that maybe we were not so well rehearsed or didn't know exactly how to do certain things. But in terms of the staging and the look of it and how to make it all work and marry with the music, I mean, we just try to do what we think is going to look exciting and fit with the mood of it, but we don't always spend that long, you know, getting it. I feel like it's only recently on this latest album that we've actually staged things in a more theatrical way, made more of an effort visually. I mean, we've always had good lighting.
Yeah.
We've always cared about the music videos.
Yes, always.
But it was still just a band on stage playing together. We didn't have like video screens and backdrops and things most of our career. So if it came across as everything you just described about that Reykjavik gig, or you know, near to Reykjavik, then I think that's the power of the playing of the music and the, you know, just watching musicians playing and being lost in the moment. Like sometimes I'll come across old video footage of us from a few years ago, and I'll think that does look exciting. You know,
yeah.
I think Sarah drumming on stage was really good to watch and enjoying herself, and rhythmically propulsive drummer, and you know, it's like all of us doing different things on stage, and we think about, I guess we all really like clothing and fashion, and we like other people's really good stage shows like Grace Jones and Devo, and you know, we're inspired, and Kraftwerk, we're inspired by seeing those kind of different ways you can do things live. But yeah, like I say, sometimes felt like we weren't really making that
yeah.
much of a coherent effort.
Yeah.
Like we were doing our best, but we didn't have the money to have like anything more than just us on stage, because we had 7 people up there and all the amplifiers and vintage synths and everything. That's what we'd spent our money on. Not anything more kind of visually stimulating,
right.
But maybe it was enough because we were doing some good music, and
yeah.
that's what people came to see.
Exactly.
You know?
And you mentioned Devo, and I feel like between your like dance moves and your work with Mechanic Synths, there's definitely a connection. I know that you also once used Bougie Boy High as a side project, and that brilliant stage name.
Yeah.
Mother Marksbow, which I thought was so great.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a huge Devo fan as well, so I feel like recalling them when talking about performance is so important, and Kraftwerk
yeah.
actually as well.
Yeah, well, when I was younger, particularly me and Owen really liked Devo, and I think Owen put some Devo on a mixtape for me when I was at university, and he was at a different university, and he posted the tape to me, and it had all these different, mainly kind of new wave or post-punk records and pop records, like maxi 12-inch singles that he'd bought, and then he made this mixtape for me. And I think Devo were on there, and I really liked I Can't Get No Satisfaction, their cover. And then I remember buying the second album. I mean, I had the first one already, but I really liked the second one, Duty Now for the Future. And that track Timing X, which is an instrumental, was really exciting, like about a minute and a half of strange sort of disco-y weird progressive music.
Yeah,
that was very influential. And then I used to watch a video, I can't remember what it's called, but I used to have a videotape that was a Devo kind of film, you know, like it was a bit of a fictional storyline interspersed with live footage. And the look of them on stage was definitely inspiring. And when we started playing, we would line up in a row, much like Devo would.
Yeah.
You know, I remember watching that video again and again and again, thinking they're like, they've got the punk sort of energy, but the music is not really so much like punk, like UK punk. It's more like weird sort of dancey music and propulsive and jerky, and it's kind of ugly rhythmically, but it's exciting. And I just found it really, really amazing to watch. Like I think there was one clip where each one of them would step forward at a time,
right,
and
yes,
it was like they were
confronting
the audience.
Yeah,
yeah,
you do that too sometimes.
So
yeah,
yeah. So that was an influence on us deciding to line up at the front of the stage and be as near to the crowd as possible, because we had seen that and found that exciting. But also every time we ever played a gig at the beginning of our career, we had to line up at the front because we were always the first band on, and there were 2 more bands,
yes.
and then the headliner, and so there was nowhere to put the equipment, so we just set the equipment up along the front.
Yeah.
And then after a very long time, that became our thing that we did, and people were like, oh, you look like Kraftwerk.
Yeah.
we were like, oh yeah, well, that's, yeah, we like them. But it was more born out of a love
function,
for Devo and Function. Yeah, I got to see Devo in New York on the same day that we mastered our album, The Warning, which was the second one. We mastered that in New York, and I went over to attend the mastering session, and then that evening after the album was mastered, I went on my own because nobody else had gone over there with me. I'd just gone out on my own. I went to see Devo, and that was really, really good to get to see them. I thought they were amazing. I do wish I had got to see them when they were at the beginning of their career, but I wasn't born then, so it would have been hard.
And how serendipitous to kind of watch them when you're mastering one of your own projects. I think that's also really wonderful to have that connection between those two experiences as well, because even though they feel that, you know, there's so many synths and so many things going on, but there's so much humanism to their sound and the way that they perform. Weirdly, as you said, like it's jittery and it's kind of ugly, but it's so real and so raw, which is why we connect to it. What was the first show then that you ever saw? What was the first concert you ever got to watch?
The first one was Peter Gabriel.
Oh, wow.
1992.
Oh, my gosh.
He just released this album called Us, which was the long-awaited follow-up to the album So.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked his music just from hearing it as a child at home. But then so my dad had the So album with Sledgehammer and Don't Give Up and all those songs on it. Then I kind of forgot about him. But by the time that 1992 came around, he released the next album, Us, and I remember buying that in Tower Records or HMV, maybe. Tower Records, I think.
HMV, yeah.
So I would have been 12, and it was like I already liked other people like Prince, but this was like somebody else that I felt like I was discovering this album for myself. You know, it wasn't like listening to it with my dad or with friends. It was more of a like personal relationship to that album. But then because my dad had liked Peter Gabriel in the 80s, he took me to the concert. It was at a place called Earls Court Arena in West London.
Yeah.
And
I used to live nearby.
Oh, you did? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Right.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was massive as a venue. We weren't very near to the front, but he had a very theatrical, impressive stage show. He had worked with a theatre director called Robert Lepage, I think, and he had collaborated with him to put together this very kind of impressive staging of the concert. So some of the time Peter Gabriel would be like in singing from within side a red telephone box.
Yeah.
And he would be, you know, the microphone would be hidden inside the phone receiver.
Yeah.
And he'd have a very long like cable connecting him to somewhere else on stage, like a phone cable, I mean. And then Sinead O'Connor was singing on the album on two songs, and she guested with him on the two songs that she sang on the album. So when she came out, that was like the first song in the set had her, and I was like, wow, this is amazing, because I really liked her on the record, but also I really liked Nothing Compares to You, her cover of the Prince song. That was the first record I bought. So, that was exciting to hear her with him. And he did things that bands didn't really end up doing until a bit later. Like back then he had one of those cameras, which now they're called GoPro cameras.
Yes.
But back then, I guess maybe that company hadn't been formed,
created,
but he had one of those like on his head. So he, you know, on the big screens, you could see into his eyes and stuff while he was walking around on stage, and like lots of different things that to be honest, like with Hot Chip, we didn't decide to do something super theatrical and staged, but that happened to be the gig I saw. And yeah, it was really, really good. And the next gig, I think, is Prince at Wembley Stadium, which was like Prince was my favorite artist. And by that point, I would have been buying four albums in a row, like the day they came out, like the Batman album, Graffiti Bridge,
yes.
Diamonds and Pearls. And then the one he was touring at that point was one with no name. It was just the symbol that he then went on to change his name to. But that gig was great, but it was hard to enjoy because I was just so far away from the stage. Wembley Stadium is too big really to enjoy a gig.
Yeah, you know, you just end up hearing,
unless you're in the first few rows.
Yeah. You just hear everybody else's voices.
I remember just feeling and I had to stand on a chair to be able to hear anything, and I couldn't really you know. But those were the first two gigs I went to.
And I feel like those are so important, because you mentioned that was the first album that you also got to buy. And that experience of listening to something at home versus, of course, being with the fans, hearing it live, watching it on stage, those are two completely, they're comparable, but they're two completely different experiences. And the fact that you got to do that so young, and you still remember details. I love that detail of the fact that he used that camera, because Tom York started using that camera. I remember in some of Tom York's like early performances as well, he would put the camera right by his wonky eye, you know, and it's like everybody was melted in the audience, because you feel, as you said, sometimes so far away from the band at big stadiums. And when you do that, you feel like you are hanging off the person's forehead. It's such a strange feeling.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of me remembering the details, I think I probably have watched a little bit of it since the gig, like on YouTube, you know, okay. Maybe a DVD. I think a DVD, or back then it would have been a video, came out of documenting that tour. So I got to like relive it a little bit, but it still was very very powerful watching it for the first time, being in the stadium. But so I've always liked quite big artists like that, as well as more underground or smaller artists. So I've, over the years, I went from watching things like that to watching lots of kind of British bands when I was an early teen, like the Charlatans and Oasis and, you know, Spiritualized and all different bands like that. And then also when I got into American kind of independent lo-fi songwriters like Will Oldham or Smog or Jim O'Rourke, you know, they would come over and play at the Garage in London, and I would always go regularly. That was like the venue that I would see every band in for a while. And most of these gigs, if not all of them, I went with Joe from Hot Chip. So I saw big pop stars, and I saw, like, you know, more like slightly more underground, or not underground, but people playing in 200 capacity or smaller venues as well. And I went to gigs more than I ever went clubbing. I didn't really go out and immerse myself in dance music culture. I went to lots of like reggae nights. There was a regular reggae night that I went to for a while. That was in a club, and that was a bit like going to, you know, when people say, because our band is so well known for like dance music and things, they assume that we're just sort of in clubs all the time. Like, I think Joe was, but I wasn't really so much into clubbing back then. I was more into like watching a live band. And also we saw, you know, I'd go with my dad and my brothers to the Royal Festival Hall, somewhere a bit more like, or the Barbican, you know, seated venues, and watch Guru's Jazzmatazz. You know, Guru from Gangstar did that series of records with jazz musicians and things like that. And go to, like, I remember going to the Proms to hear some Frank Zappa and some Steve Reich. So it was kind of quite interested in lots of different things, and some probably pretty bad music to you. I'm not just trying to name drop the good ones.
Yeah.
But I spent a lot of time just really absorbed
and discovery
in records and gigs and and it was really very, very important, and some of it feels really fresh to me now. You know, I remember buying Spiritualized album, Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space, and then being at the concert the same evening and hearing it, only having had the afternoon to listen to it after school.
Right.
But then you get to hear it live, and they just played the whole album pretty much in order.
Yeah.
But I don't remember feeling disappointed that I didn't know the material better. I felt like I just really focused on it for an afternoon, and then it was exciting to hear that live rendition of it. And it was, yeah, really, really, like you were saying, the live thing and the records are quite different from each other. It was very, very exciting to hear it transformed onto the stage.
Yeah, and so important just to be able to go to shows, and as you mentioned, not just the good shows, just be kind of escape into that. And it's weird because you mentioned the Charlatans. I had Tim on the show last year when we first launched. He was one of my first guests, and he was chatting also about how that gig culture is so, it's so transformative for an artist, because you're not only experiencing that music live as anyone would around you, but as an artist, you're taking in that discovery of it, and you're taking it in as almost learning in a way, whether you reflect on it, whether you act on it like you did with Devo, whether you learn the steps or learn anything from it, some sort of subconscious mind meld is happening where it's just seeping in. And that's always amazing to hear or to speak about. It's so fascinating. And weirdly, that makes me think I stalked your Instagram the other day, because I was like, oh, I'm going to speak to him. Let me look at your Instagram, which I barely ever do.
Yeah.
But I looked and I saw there's some videos that you posted of what I'm assuming is you and your child covering, the one video? It was Kanye's Bound. That was so much fun to watch, I have to say, from an outsider's perspective, because I'm sure that wasn't planned or rehearsed, but it just, the love of music
came across.
No, it wasn't
rehearsed. When I first heard that song, I have to admit, I don't like everything that he does.
Right.
But I did really like his first album when it came out.
Mm.
And exactly.
Mm.
But every now and again, he'll make something that I think is much more interesting than maybe it gets credit for. Like the one he made with Paul McCartney, where it's just Paul McCartney playing the Wurlitzer and Kanye West singing.
Yeah.
That's something I really like. And I think it's quite sort of stylistically modern to do something which just uses an old-fashioned instrument, but the production values of the sound of the vocal, the sound of the backing vocals, when they cut through, are kind of extreme and loud and sharp and sort of modern sounding. And it's quite brave to just take away drums and bass and everything else and make a very empty track and make it a commercially successful song. I think it's really interesting. And then with the one Bound that me and Prudence were singing at the piano, the song sounds to me like it's made up of two quite unconnected pieces of music. One of them is the sample from the Ponderosa Twins track, which features the kind of Bound lyrics, I think that band was young people performing, so the singer's voice is very high because he's only a teenager or younger, and so that's the main part of music you hear. But then the chorus with Charlie Wilson singing, which is not a sample but it's something that they did in the studio, and it has completely different production values. It's like a noisy synth and a vocal, and not really anything else. When that comes in, I just find the juxtaposition between those two sections of music really thrilling, And it's partly to do with the key change, the modulation from the sample that he's using from Bound to this other bit. And they sound perfectly right, but when I sat down to work out what that change is on the piano, like what key it goes from to which one, it doesn't sound to me like a key change or a modulation I've ever heard in other pop songs. Mm. And I feel like that happens because he's working with six different producers at once on
on one song.
And he's like, somebody's like, well, what about if we had this sample in the something? Yeah, that sounds good. And, what about if we did it? And that ability to throw those things together can lead to really interesting results. I mean, I don't know if that's how it happened, but that's certainly what it sounds like. And I just think if you sit down on your own with a guitar and write a song, you're not likely to make that
connection,
that chord progression that he made. Yeah. So I really love being inspired by those moments in pop music where you can be like, wow, that is really unconventional, but really exciting and really sort of direct. It hits you. And so I just wanted to like, I was never going to cover the whole song and like learn Kanye West rap, because most of it is stuff I wouldn't really ever say. But I like the singing part, so I just wanted to, I was just trying it out on my own. And I had a gig the next day, and I was thinking, I wonder if I'm going to try and cover this song. And then my daughter came into the room, and I realised at that point, well, she could probably sing the bit that the child sings on the band original song.
But she's got such a beautiful voice. Like, it kind of blew me away, because there's a hint at the end of it where, like, in the beginning you could see she wasn't, like, maybe, I don't know, she doesn't know how good she is. But at the end you could feel that she realized, oh, hang on, I can make this note. And there was this beautiful, like, flutter. It went into two tones. And I was like, oh, my gosh, that's something that I think, I don't know. I just wanted more. Maybe that was just me being, like, grossly selfish as an onlooker. I love that.
I think
so cool.
When I posted it, I actually forgot that I posted it, because I posted it like 3 days after I'd filmed it. And then when I next looked at Instagram, I had like all of these messages from people saying really nice things about it.
So I
definitely connected with lots of people. It connected with people more than any of my other posts. So you're not the only person.
I mean, I like your other content, but Prudence is the one that's gonna they're gonna get the eyes. But I wanted to just touch on something that you said, which I found quite thoughtful and insightful in terms of pop music and finding those notes that are unconventional. And obviously, the origins of A Bath Full of Ecstasy, your new album, that ties into writing music for a pop star, I believe. Beyond writing for another person, did you find yourself thinking differently in terms of that pop structure for somebody on that celebrity stage? Like, when it came time to use songs that you'd originally conceived in those sessions, was it kind of like a mindfuck to reinvent your own songs then to become back, become your own again?
No, not really. There was enough of us in the demos that we'd written to offer to Katy Perry, that when we chose to use, so one song made it onto her album, but the ones that didn't, these two tracks that are, one of them is called Spell and one is called Echo. Firstly, we changed them quite a lot from the demos, but the kind of, particularly with Spell, the core of that song remains the same. It's just the chorus. I wrote a new set of chords and words for the chorus, but the verses remain much like what we presented to her.
Okay.
To get it back to being something for us didn't feel that difficult, because when we were demoing it, I put my voice on the track and, Joe produced it. We didn't really have that much experience for writing for somebody else.
at that point anyway. So maybe what we were doing was writing another Hot Chip song. Yeah. We just had her in mind. The thing that was different was, I think it was quite freeing lyrically to be writing for her rather than for us and about me. So I was trying to like imagine what she would feel comfortable singing or what would be the kind of mood she might want. So the words are a little bit, I think they're similar to Hot Chip other songs, but they're maybe a little bit more playful with the idea of it being a kind of sensual, seductive song, you know, because you're trying, maybe it's quite freeing, I know that's a bit of a cliche, but just to imagine it's going to be somebody else performing it and singing it and being the front person to it. That's why a lot of those like classic Cole Porter songs, or like all the songs that, you know, there were writers behind songs, but there were performers for the songs. You can say some really interesting and sophisticated things in that era of pop music, maybe because people are not having to put themselves on stage and be a front person, but they can just craft something that is about how people feel, and then somebody else has to front it. I mean, I don't know if I've really expressed that particularly well, but you can kind of, yeah, you can sort of be hiding behind the scenes to some extent, but saying something very revealing, and that you get that in lots of early songwriting for Ella Fitzgerald or, you know, Billie Holiday or Baker, or all the kind of standards from that era. And I think that you also get it in the more modern pop music, where it's Kathy Dennis or somebody writing the song for Kylie Minogue, and maybe even singing on it and doing backing vocals and so on. There's a lot more of writer that goes into those things than maybe people would realise. So, yeah, I've ended up talking more about how it's fun to write for somebody else rather than how we turned it back into our own track. But I just thought they were really good songs and deserved to be finished. And I think also the timing was really good. So when Katy Perry asked us to work with her, me and Joe hadn't been working on any new Hot Chip music at that point for a good few months. So the studio time we put in together was fun, because we'd all finished touring and had a break, and then just me and Joe got together to start writing these tracks for Katy Perry. We were excited by that, like a quite nice thing to be asked to do, and we also were feeling the pressure. So we worked hard, came up with 8 songs like in 2 days or something, because we thought, well, what if we turn up in the studio and she expects quite a lot. So we just really so I think that meant that we put a lot of good work in ahead of the time, like way ahead of the time that we actually began on this Hot Chip album. But it was quite good, because we did this thing for somebody else, some of it didn't get used, and then you're like, oh, we've already got some good ideas. So that makes you feel comfortable beginning the rest of the album. Whereas I think if you're starting totally from scratch, you can sometimes feel a bit pressured. You know, what are we going to come up with now? Like, we've done 6 albums already.
Have we got good
ideas for the 7th one? Yeah.
And that's interesting, I suppose, because obviously working, it's not like it didn't come from the same place. You know, it's not like you just press a button and you're suddenly a different person writing different songs. I'm sure there's different layers of you as a writer that you can access for your different projects, which you do just listening to your, you know, solo work, the more stripped down work. It's still coming from the same vessel, you know, and going in with an agenda of knowing that it's for somebody else, I suppose it takes the pressure off slightly, but I'm sure you still put in the effort, but I can't believe you did that in 2 days. Is that a normal pace?
Well, maybe it was 3 days. I can't remember now.
They're the truth. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking.
We did work quickly, and we worked hard, and I think that maybe it's unusual to have that many so quickly, but the way in which we've always worked on the beginnings of songs, so the demo stage, and it didn't used to be called the demo stage. It just was how we made all the records that were really demoing and then doing them again. They just were that. We would need a break from one song because we'd been on it for like all morning. So we would start on another one and then we'd work on two and then maybe the third idea that Joe had just a beat for, but not more than that, we'd start on that. So you want two or three things simultaneously in one day, but you don't finish any of them and then come back to them the next day and try and get further with them. And I think we have been good at generating quite a lot. And I have to also take my hat off to Joe himself for often coming up with lots and lots of beginnings, lots and lots of,
yes,
you know, ideas. I come up with lots too, but I think he works harder than anyone else I've ever met in the music world in terms of just making music every day, you know. So it reminds me of Prince, really, in terms of the work ethic. I'm able to contribute to that, you know, help turn that into a song or whatever, put words on it, put keyboards on it, write chords, do things. You know, if it's just a bass line and a drum pattern, we come up with a lot more together. But sometimes Joe's got a lot more than that on his own. So it's, yeah, obviously sometimes I turn up and I've got songs I've written at home and just say, I want to try this out. And, you know, we like to work quickly. And I don't also really like to work on one song for like 6 weeks.
Too
if I can
long.
Help it.
Yeah.
Get quite bored quickly. So try to move on.
Is there anything about being a professional artist or professional musician as such that you didn't expect when you first started out?
It's quite a privileged position to be in sometimes. People give you clothes and that's quite weird to be given things.
Yes.
It's nice. I'm not complaining. It's quite strange. I don't think it's peculiar to music. I think it's in lots of entertainment industries, but it is quite strange sometimes to think the people that can afford to buy things are being given them for free and the people that can't afford to buy things
just buying,
are looking at the people wearing them and then wanting to buy them or something. You know.
Capitalism!
I remember early on in my career being quite fascinated by the behind-the-scenes industry of it, like going to a mastering studio and how many rooms of people were there all working on mixing or mastering records and taking seriously an industry that I'd always cared about, loved. You know, I hadn't cared about the industry. I'd loved the records that people put out. But then seeing the wind, like getting to see behind the scenes and seeing the sort of seriousness with which people took it, I found that quite inspiring, you know, because sometimes music can be seen as merely entertainment and a kind of frippery. And so I enjoyed meeting people, seeing people working hard on it, and also meeting people in the industry who really were passionate about records and, you know, just all of that.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod, and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already. Thank you. everybody. Thanks again for listening. Here's a last minute reminder that StubHub is the best place to score the tickets you need whenever you need them. Backed by their 100% fan protect guarantee, StubHub has the seats you want at the price you want to pay. And they're never sold out, so you can score tickets up to the last minute. Head to StubHub.com now and enjoy the show.
Consequence Podcast Network.